Welcome to another Stanlib Asset Management podcast. My name is Dave Watson, and I'm one of the investment specialists at Stanlib. Today, I'm chatting to Marius Oberholzer, who's head of the Stanlib multi-asset business. And today, we're going to be chatting about the second quarter of 2025. Quarter two was, I guess, another continuation from Q1, really, of really jam-packed with striking headlines, lots of information for investors and clients to absorb. So really just an opportunity for us to unpack that through the lens of our multi-asset team. Marius, thanks for your time and looking forward to hearing your insights as always. And importantly, I guess, really taking a chance to step back, go back to the beginning of, you know, quarter two, which in some ways feels like a lifetime ago. And just to take us through really how views have developed and how we've responded as a team to some of the, call it, striking headlines we have seen during the course of the quarter.
Hi, Dave, and hello to the listeners. It was interesting to hear you say, you know, it's been a continuation of headline risk. It certainly felt a lot more than headline risk through April, May, and certainly June as well. Markets had been struggling since the beginning of the year, and one might even suggest at the back end of last year started struggling with a few of the prevailing narratives. But as everyone on the call will know, you know, the quarter was really started off with chaotic announcements from President Trump in the US around the Liberation Day tariffs. And it wasn't so much the direction of travel. We knew the tariffs were coming. It was the chaotic nature of the way they got to the tariff numbers, the complete, which would appear, ignorance around the impact on asset markets around the world, and then the subsequent behavior post that. If you recall, we were expecting tariffs. We flagged that in our roadshows at the beginning of the year. We'd flagged it into the Trump election in November. But our positive view around the United States and asset markets and potentially even the Trump administration was really born from three pillars, which was, you know, you'd have tariffs, which would be a negative for markets, but potentially a positive for the United States fiscal position. We didn't think it would be as big an inflationary impact as people were expecting, and I think we maintain that view. But we thought that Trump would announce his three-prong approach, which would include tariffs, deregulation, and cutting taxes at the same time. And what we clearly got wrong was the sequencing of those announcements, with the negative being tariffs announced chaotically with undue consideration for the impacts of the markets and no corresponding good news policy coming in the form of deregulation or tax cuts. And the markets reacted pretty negatively, and I think that was the same for us. And it wasn't just equity markets. The markets actually became quite unhinged, whether it was the Treasury curve, whether it was the Japanese bond curve. There were a number of reasons for that as well. But ultimately, asset markets everywhere became unhinged. And it was quite a scary 5 or 6 days in the markets. And I would suggest it was probably one of the more scary episodes of market activity that I've seen in the last sort of 5-10 years. I mean, we've had a few of these types of air pockets, if you like, but it was pretty scary, because I think specifically we were seeing correlations break down between the old traditional dollars, bonds, equities, and there was really nowhere to hide for a multi-asset fund, and I would suggest for any type of investor. But we saw that announcement, and we saw the steady hand of Scott Bessent especially coming to the fore and really assuring markets, specifically the fixed income markets, that things were okay. And I would say the commentary that we got from Bessent, and then at the later stages of kind of the middle of April from President Trump, was very much a walking back of the aggressive rhetoric. The tariffs themselves were going to remain. There were going to be negotiations around it, but really the aggressive stance that he took started to be just walked back a little bit. And that gave the markets the opportunity to recover some of their losses, and they did. But it was spectacular in fashion in how aggressively the markets recovered those losses and surpassed where they had been on April the 2nd, when that Liberation Day announcement took place. And as we know, as we stand here in the early part of July, markets have made new highs around the world, arguably, around many different sectors, around many factors, and certainly equity markets. And there seems to be very little concern around the impact of tariffs, either on global economic growth, as flagged by our chief economist, Mr. Lings, but also on the impact of earnings, which are coming through not just from tariff, but from a very aggressive adjustment in the currency markets. So as an example, we've had a euro dollar rate that moved from kind of the low 103 to the dollar to now, you know, when got to almost 120 versus the dollar, with calls that euro would be able to buy $1.30 towards the end of this year, as some of these policies from Mr. Trump augur in a new macroeconomic regime, a new geopolitical geoeconomic regime, which has been brewing for some time. But these have created significant adjustments in markets, significant changes in I think portfolio managers around the world in the way they view market, around the way they're viewing equities, and specifically around the way they're reviewing regional exposure. And so there are lots of different outcomes, I think, from industry participants over the last quarter, and remains to be seen how that will play out over the ensuing months, quarters, and years. So a really interesting component. To bring that to what we did, we got a little bit cautious on markets back in January when the DeepSeek news came about, and we wrote about that at the time, and what we felt was there were going to be some questions around the multiples that people would pay for the what we call the hyperscalers or the Mag 7, and specifically areas of froth where there's been AI forecasts and expectations built into markets, which were perhaps slightly ahead of themselves, given the DeepSeek news, which puts AI capabilities in everyone's hands. Certainly not DeepSeek itself, but certainly that was the indication that came through. What we've seen post that was obviously this liberation tariff that added to that, and we saw significant underperformance from tech and the Magnificent Seven going into that tariff announcement. Subsequently, we've seen the US itself outperform Europe through the quarter. That wasn't the case at the beginning of the year in the first quarter. We've seen the Magnificent Seven, or Big Tech, Nvidia, if you like, re-exert its dominance. And we've seen phenomenal earnings numbers in the early indications around the United States earnings materialize. And to some degree, this notion that U.S. exceptionalism is over being dispelled, which was our view that it would be dispelled, that the U.S. remains exceptional. But to paraphrase Mark Rowan of Apollo, the U.S. is exceptional, just a little less exceptional than it was 6 or 9 months ago. And you've had a really narrow market back into technology, not just the Magnificent Seven, but back into technology, as well as some performance on thematic things like the defense, global defense. We've had some change in rhetoric around the trade tariffs. We've had some deals, notably the UK, during the quarter. They were the first off the ramp, and sort of more recently, we've had places like Indonesia and others doing some deals with the US, which removes uncertainty as it relates to those different markets. And those markets have reacted very favorably to the uncertainty being removed. Our team has migrated from being maybe cautious in December to even more cautious in March. I think the move in the Liberation Day announcements caught us a little bit less short than we would have liked to be. And we were certainly not aggressive in terms of buying the dip, if you like, because of the uncertainty around the outcomes of the economic environment, around the policy environment. Notwithstanding that, because of our process, momentum did force us back into those markets through the quarter, and we sit fully risked as we entered the third quarter or the third quarter of this year, fully risked in our multi-asset portfolios with decent equity exposure, but certainly being very careful around how we take that equity exposure currently. So it wasn't a great quarter for us. We lost a little bit of money in our alpha strategies, systematic solutions, our offshore JP Morgan strategies. Some of our other internal strategies did very well. And our asset allocation, I think, was broadly pretty good. So it's not a disaster by any means, but we've seen our bottom-up strategies struggling to some degree over the last quarter, two quarters, even longer. So it's been about three quarters of underperformance from our bottom-up strategies, which is concerning, but you can't always make money, and these strategies have been very, very successful over a long period of time, and we stick with them, whether that's in equities, offshore, or internally in our fixed income strategies.
Yeah, thanks, Marius. And I guess it's easy with hindsight to be sometimes overly critical of, you know, the team's performance, but I think, again, some of the points you've touched on speak to what has been a very difficult market to navigate, in the sense that, especially around the policy uncertainty, the implementation of tariffs. I mean, we still sit today yet to see exactly how that materializes, how that comes through, and, you know, affecting earnings, etc. So a very challenging environment to navigate. So I think clients will be understanding of that, and I think a prudent environment to have been a little bit more cautious going through that initial period, and then subsequently re-risking the portfolio. Marius, one other thing that I know you and the team spend quite a lot of time thinking about is creating that positive asymmetry within client portfolios. And I guess to ensure that even if a view doesn't materialize exactly as we expect, we don't stand to lose a lot of money. Maybe you could chat us through how you and the team have executed on that recently, and I guess brought some additional optionality into portfolios.
Yeah, so I mean, great question. And I think it's depending on the capability that we're deploying into. So, you know, in our business, we manage hedge fund money, we manage our absolute return money, and then multi-strategy type approach in the multi-asset world. You will deploy derivatives to varying degrees across those strategies, but the thought process is similar. It's just how much exposure and how aggressively asymmetric we want to try and be with portfolios. And I think there's an incredibly interesting environment right now. And I mean, it's a hell of an interesting macro environment, and it has been for a year or two already. But what's really interesting is this world that we've sort of touched on, that was so uncertain and so volatile, hasn't manifested in the price of options around the world. And the way options prices around the world are really dictate or price predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly, is through something called implied volatility. So volatility is the movement of prices, not value, but prices of an underlying asset. And implied volatility is taking a view around the forward looking volatility of assets. And generally, forward looking volatility will always be priced a little bit higher than where realized volatility or is historic volatility observed, clearly because people want to potentially pay a higher price to insure against uncertainty. And what we're seeing is the pricing of options, whether it's in foreign exchange, whether it is in fixed income, or whether it is in equities, is trading a little bit cheaper than what we would see over long-term historic periods. So in the South African equity markets or in the US equity markets, volatility realizes at around 17 or 18%. And that's, your listeners will understand that from asset to volatility type scatter plots. And what we're seeing in South Africa especially is we're seeing volatility being priced at around 15. So that's a 3-point discount to historic volatility. And our markets are not behaving in the short run as very volatile markets. They're moving nicely higher in a fairly constructive manner. But we think over the long term, if you're a buyer of volatility, when prices are cheap like this, you can have your cake and eat it. And we've talked about this once or twice over the previous few years, is you can buy equities and protect against your equity exposure. You're giving up some of your returns if markets go up, but certainly you're able to have your cake and eat it. And so we've been fairly aggressive in terms of trying to participate through equity optionality, both on the upside and on the downside. So we've been buyers of insurance both ways. We've talked a lot over the last few quarters about risk being very much two-way, right-hand side and left-hand side. And so we're buyers of volatility to protect our portfolios in some instances, and buyers of volatility or optionality to participate in markets if they continue to perform, which we think there's a large tailwind now post the tariff chaos.
that will come about. And asset markets look okay. They don't look terrible. They don't look like a dripping roast by any means. But we think there's enough going on to make us constructive on risk at the margin on a kind of tactical horizon. But by using the optionality, we think we can sleep well at night and create some form of asymmetry in markets. And if we're wrong, as you say, we won't lose a lot of money. And part of our job, and certainly the way we approach managing money, is managing risk first and foremost on the downside. We want our clients to be able to trade their long or invest on a long-term basis. And part of doing that means that we need to create a smoother return profile so they can stick to their plan over the longer term rather than get washed out in moments of madness like we had in April or August last year or COVID, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how we're thinking about it. In our absolute return funds, that's been much more aggressive. In our multi-strat funds, less aggressive, but certainly doing that and engaging in the same level of thinking. And what that does is it puts you on the front foot when markets do have these big moves, either higher or lower. So our absolute return funds, because of the degree of optionality they carried, were very much on the front foot in April and were actually buying much more aggressively because our equity exposure had dropped to zero at that point because of our protection strategy. So that gives you a sense of what we're doing. And we're doing that in fixed income markets at the margin. We're certainly doing that in currency markets where it's become very, very interesting, as I mentioned, and in equities predominantly because that's where we carry most of our portfolio risk.
Thanks, Mario. So I think you also touched on such a important point there in terms of client journey and creating a client journey that is palatable for investors in these types of mandates. Because, you know, it doesn't help if, yes, over a 5 or 10 year period, your fund has great performance, but the volatility of that journey means you actually don't have anyone left in the fund to experience it because it's just not a client journey that can be stomached. So I think a very important point that you touched on there. And Maurice, to quote something that you often say around, you know, capital goes where it's treated best. Maybe you could spend a little bit of time just chatting to us in terms of where you're currently seeing capital flowing within various asset classes, various markets. And maybe just where possible, if there's any views that you feel the team are taking at the moment that are a little bit away from the consensus view.
Yeah, I mean, capital goes where it's treated best is certainly a mantra we live by. And I think it's incredibly important in emerging markets, especially, you know, the drivers of return are not always fundamentals in emerging markets, and even developed markets, some might say, is very much driven by flow of capital. I think the biggest question we're asking ourselves now is, has the environment changed for the US with the chaos of the Trump administration, with the change in geopolicy that's taking place from the Trump administration, whether that's aggressively changing the NATO environment, whether that's aggressively changing trade deals and old trade alliances, political alliances, the allies, versus the BRIC, and how that manifests around the dollar. And we keep coming back to the dollar, and we don't want to because there's so much more going on in markets. But I think working out where the dollar is going to go is clearly a big deal, and clients will be aware of that because there is a potential view that the dollar may have peaked. As people say, US exceptionalism is over. Our view is a little bit nuanced that it's not over, it's just less exceptional, borrowing that Mark Rowan phrase. And we saw that rotation as people moved away from US assets very aggressively in that first quarter into places like Europe, to a lesser degree in emerging markets, but they did. And even into a place like the UK, where some of the political environment itself is also one of supreme volatility and uncertainty. But we still believe that the flow of capital will remain to the United States because of the rule of law. I use that almost in inverted commas, the rule of law in the US being better than elsewhere, shareholder rights being better than elsewhere, return on equity in the United States being better than elsewhere, the regulatory environment from a stock market principle, insider trading, minority protection, all being better. So we think that remains. We do think that investors are going to sit up and really take note of the currency volatility and potentially hedge out some of that. And I think that's real and that's changed, which means that the dollar itself might not be as aggressively priced as it once was. But we're still keen on the U.S. over the medium term relative to, you know, Europe, for instance, where we think the currency strength will hurt. To bring it back to where capital is treated best, I mean, the most extreme example of that over the last 12 months or 18 months has certainly been Argentina, with a change in leadership, a change in policy from an economics perspective, central bank perspective, political perspective, has led to an enormous return in that market, whether it be in fixed income currency or in equity markets. Just a simple shift in policy, and it's something that we hope for in South Africa, maybe not to that extreme, but just a change that will lead to a realization from investors that things have changed and they're for the better from an investor perspective. Where we're seeing that manifest in our portfolios. Japan has been a hot story for investors for probably 2 years or so, and talking to the change in the way the Tokyo Stock Exchange is viewing companies and trying to ensure that they deliver better shareholder returns in Tokyo has led to a lot of investors climbing into that market with a view that it's fundamentally cheap, both in the short run and the long run, and there's significant corporate change taking place because of those stock exchange rules. It hasn't really manifested in fantastic returns in hard currency. It manifested in fantastic returns, I think, in 2023, if I'm not mistaken, in equity returns. But the yen weakened and offset some of that. But the reality is that the shareholder is being treated differently in Japan now than it was over the last few years. We've used this dip that we saw in April to increase our Japanese exposure, specifically because we were more comfortable with the currency level of dollar-yen trading in the low 140s versus the 160s previously, and we'll do that on a currency-hedged basis. The other place that I think is maybe different to our peers is Korea. South Korea had an election post a period of evoking martial law by its previous president and then him being removed and impeached, and we had an election in South Korea, which led to a change in leadership. But what that change in leadership has manifested is similar to Japan. They've approached the world of ensuring that minority shareholders are going to be protected to a very large degree in an environment and in a country where holding company structures have been incredibly penal for shareholders. And control has been exerted by a number of families and major shareholders to the tune that the holdco discounts are much bigger than 50 or 60% even in some cases. And where we've used this example of the sell-off in markets is to position ourselves in South Korea with that change. And those changes in legislation, not just at a stock exchange level, but it's actually been, we believe it to soon be inscribed in law, that boards of companies will actually be criminally liable if they treat minority shareholders unfavorably relative to the way they treat majority shareholders. And we think that's a big shift at a point in time where the South Korean won is relatively cheap, at a point in time where emerging markets are showing a much higher degree of attractiveness, we think, now than they were 3, 6, 9, 12, and 18 months ago. At the same time as we think that the AI and tech theme is broadening out away from the United States into places like South Korea, Taiwan. Well, Taiwan was always part of it, Japan, and we think investors are more willing to embrace global proxies for that rather than just the US. So that's a place that we're trying to position in, not just from a country level, but certainly with that area, and we believe that will be a long-term investment at the same time as the Japanese side. So those are two areas where we think we're slightly different, maybe to peers. I don't know what peers are doing, but those are the areas that we're starting to embrace at the margin, notwithstanding that a big picture, we still like the US, and we still like secular technology. We still like the secular themes that we've been playing successfully over the last couple of years.
Yeah, thanks for those insights, Marius. And I mean, on the AI and tech space, it's been interesting to see how the narrative has started to shift from saying the initial, I suppose, run we've seen in that space in terms of share prices and companies that have really done well has been initially your if you can call it, creators of whether it's your actual hardware, et cetera, that enables that tech and AI capability. But you're starting to see a shift now where those who are actually a second run of those who actually implement that technology successfully within various industries are going to sort of be the next round of beneficiaries of this technology, not just the guys who are, you know, necessarily your MagSeven guys who are enabling the technology. And Maurice, maybe just to stay with that, I mean, and a slightly different question rather than asking you to unpack the views around the MagSeven, I'd be curious to hear yourself as a team, how are you guys perhaps implementing or using AI and technology or embracing it within your team and your process?
Dave, first to acknowledge the point you made around AI and that second level moving from kind of the hyperscalers. I think that's 100% correct, and we're expecting to see that manifest in earnings. We've already seen it to some degree. It'll manifest in earnings and margins, and I think that'll be the next leg that will push our equity markets higher, certainly in our thinking. But to bring it back to our team, we've been building AI capabilities both at a standard level and specifically within our team over the last few years. We've got some fantastic resources within the team, spearheaded specifically by Dr. Streetfield. And he wrote a piece, I think, maybe a year ago, which is on our website, around garbage in, garbage out, and also around some of the AI efforts that we were doing. And really, it's all about bringing efficiency to the table. We don't want to allow black box thinking to encroach on our investment process, but we do want some insights and some signals coming from wider data sets than we've historically been able to access, or wider data sets that could come at us much more frequently. And one of the ways that we're doing that is to capture the stream of consciousness in the team, which is a fancy way of saying that all our meetings as a team are recorded, as well as every research piece or email that we send to each other around thoughts, ideas, views that are either being thought about and improved upon, questions and answers that the team are flying back at each other around these bits of work that we then throw into what we call our wishing well. And we've built a large language model that can go and find those views for us at literally the touch of a button or the touch of a prompt, where we will ask it, can you give us the team's latest views around oil, broadly speaking, as an example, and we will be able to attach the team's broad thought processes, conversations, bits of research that we've had that we've been able to access and discuss. What we're not able to do is obviously leverage into our research providers, the likes of the banks or our independent research, where we can't really use large language models to train on their information. But we are utilizing all of our conversations to then really just speed up the ability for to bring that information to the front of everybody's minds, to write reports for us, to pull out interesting data sets, the most recent data sets, the trend on data. And so we don't have to calculate those things in Excel anymore the way we would have had to, or ask Kevin, you know, what's the trend over the last 6 months on this specific portion of PMI, et cetera. It's all at our fingertips that we can pull up, and we can access that research from the bits of research that we get, not just as our team, but certainly from within the StanLib kind of capability across the board, which, you know, is deep and wide and well specialized. So that's how we're using that at a very broad level.
Yeah, thanks, Maurice. It's good to hear that the teams are embracing it, because I think, similar to all other industries, it's just absolutely crucial that a business like ourselves embrace that, especially within investment management, where, as we know, I mean, public information is available equally to everyone. Really what differentiates you or sets you apart from your peer group is how you're actually utilizing and processing that information that's available to you. So really good to get some insights as to how your team are doing that and doing so quite effectively.
Yeah, and I think, Dave, that it's an important component is that it's our data. And so we're utilizing our data, our information flow, our thoughts and processes. So to some degree, it's already been filtered in the way we have conversations, the meetings we have, our tactical asset allocation meetings, et cetera, et cetera. But we're using our data. So it's really
filtered data already. I think there's a lot more that we can do, but, you know, if I think of myself as kind of being towards the end of my career, been doing this for a long time, even I'm finding it exciting, and I'm finding that, you know, there are not many tricks that I can still learn as an old dog. The stuff is really exciting, and really the ability to just have a conversation with, whether it's our internal large language model or paid large language models like Claude or Grok or whatever, as you walk down the street thinking about an investment world, the potential paths, the things that these large language models might have highlighted you haven't thought about, or that you have thought about and they're confirming, right? I think these are really powerful things that you can do while you're driving in your car or walking around the block as you catch a breath of fresh air, you know. So it's a tool that we need to embrace, not ad hoc, but as a part of our working life, day to day. And I know people are, and as I say, even the old dogs are. I mean, the people are using it to varying degrees, but I think it is something that's going to become de jure across our industry and across the world and across every industry. And it's going to make a big difference to the way we work. Clearly, there are downsides with that as well, which is not the topic of the conversation. But certainly from a company's perspective, you would expect efficiencies to go up. You would expect margins to go up. You would expect productivity to go up. That's all good for a shareholder, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been fascinating to, you know, we're living in a really interesting period as this develops, and just internal conversations, you know, every week you sort of have a conversation with a colleague who brings up just another way that they're implementing this into their broader life, as you say, whether it's on the commute to work, how they're, you know, going through research reports, etc. I think we'll leave it there in the interest of time, but Marius, thanks again for sharing your insights. All the best to you and the team as you continue to navigate these markets. Thank you to all of our clients and all the interested parties who took the time to listen to this podcast. And if you do want to have a further discussion about any of our multi-asset propositions, you're very welcome to reach out to myself or one of the other Stanlib investment specialists. We're always very eager to engage. But for now, thank you for your time, and we'll chat again soon.
Stanlib is an authorized financial services provider in terms of the FASE Act and a registered manager in terms of Cisco. Please refer to the MDD or fact sheet available on www.stanlib.com for additional information about this fund. This should not be construed as advice.